Good morning and happy Sunday. Welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and for about an hour, I'm going to be talking to you about things like current events and news. But mostly, we're going to talk today about taxes. Tax season is upon us, and we get ourselves into a lot of trouble as individuals and as small businesses in particular when we don't pay Uncle Sam what Uncle Sam requires us to pay. You know, he's got to get his cut. And as my theme has been for the last couple of weeks about gems being in our backyard of Baltimore, that theme will continue this week because we have another gem in the backyards of Baltimore that will help us stay out of tax trouble. They have been around since 1957, and because their expertise has been multi-generational, meaning it has been passed down from father to son to daughter, they continue with their service of helping small minority businesses and individuals with their tax concerns. We will also talk to the Petty and find out what his picks are for this weekend's games in the XFL, get some information on the NFL, and we've got some news about Lamar Jackson. And I say it like that because it's sad news, potentially very sad news. And the Petty will give us the 411 on that, so you want to stay tuned for that information. But at first, you've got me, and I'm going to give you news and commentary on things that have gone on in Baltimore and the rest of the world this past week. So I hope you're feeling great because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to tell you, so let's get right to it. Apparently, a drug house is opening legally in Montgomery County. Well, let me put it another way. A cannabis lounge is opening in Montgomery County. It's called the Sealand House. And if you've never heard of anything like this before in Maryland, it's because it's the first in the state ever to open. Essentially, it's a bar-type hangout, but instead of alcohol, cigars, or hookahs, patrons will be smoking weed. Now, for the first few months, only medical marijuana users can come in. Recreational marijuana becomes legal in July, which includes smoking, possessing, and growing cannabis for adults 21 and older. Opponents of the concept say it's a bit too close for comfort as it sits just a mile from two separate schools and is already next to a cannabis dispensary. Venus Hamachandra, who owns both businesses, say that her new spot will be a safe place to meet people and learn about some new products. Unlike a cigar bar, visitors cannot purchase the product that they smoke inside, but the dispensary right next door, which is owned by the same person, will be open most days. Those who want to hang out at the lounge will be carded, and a doctor's sign-off and proof that they are registered with the state will be required. But after July, all you'll need is an ID showing that you're 21 years or older. Now, unfortunately, due to county health rules, the lounge is not allowed to have food or drinks. They can't sell them inside. But Hamachandra is going to have food trucks in the parking lot on the weekends for those patrons who have the munchies. Now, there are some rules and regulations, and the business was required to install a special HVAC system and buy hefty insurance premiums. Customers must sign a waiver when they enter the place, and they have to stop smoking weed 30 to 60 minutes before they leave. So look, I don't smoke weed, never have, not my thing, never been my thing, but I don't judge. I mean, you know, do you? But I do have a question. How are you going to monitor whether someone has stopped smoking 30 to 60 minutes before they leave? And how do you know how long marijuana stays in someone's system? I'm just curious. I mean, in July, when it's a free-for-all, when anybody can come in who's over 21, when they come in, is there a two or three blunt maximum you can smoke in a certain amount of time? Is there someone counting that? Is somebody watching or monitoring that? I mean, weed, just like alcohol, affects different people differently, and everybody has a different tolerance for it, right? So I guess what I'm asking is, how do we know that the person that waited 30 or 60 minutes is as good to go as the other person that waited 30 to 60 minutes before they get in their car and they drive down the road? I mean, I'm just curious. I don't know. I have so many questions. Just last month in a bar in Connecticut, a regular customer of that bar got stupid drunk, got in his vehicle, drove 3 miles from that bar, crossed the center line on the highway, and killed a family of three that were traveling in the opposite direction in a minivan. Now, the driver, the drunk guy, was fine. He was obviously arrested and he awaits trial. But what they did was that they didn't just charge the driver of that vehicle, they actually charged the bartender for over-serving this customer. So in a situation where you have a marijuana lounge and you're bringing in your own marijuana, you can't purchase it on the premises, but you can smoke to your heart's delight, and all you have to do is wait for 30 to 60 minutes before you leave. When you leave that place, if you are in fact high, still impaired, and you get into an accident, and I gotta be honest, it's inevitable. Someone's gonna do it. Who is going to be at fault? And I know what some of you are saying. You're saying, Brian, there are people out here smoking weed every day in their cars anyway. I worked at Passport BMW for a short stint, which borders both Virginia and DC, but sits in Suitland, Maryland. Shout out to Passport. And I would stand in the service lane, and I'm talking at like 7 o'clock in the morning, and the cars would roll into the service lane when the bay doors opened, and the whole service bay would smell like weed. So much so that at times, you know, the service manager and some of the service guys had to open up all of the doors so that they could get fresh air because the smell was that strong. And the customers that had smoked the weed, some of them were so baked by the time they got in there after a ride from their home to the service department that they couldn't even tell us what they came in for in the first place. I promise you this is not made up. So I am so curious to see how long this weed lounge stays open. And I am even more curious as to how much she paid in liability insurance. Also in the news, ABC News is reporting that a car crashed through the terminal of Wilmington, North Carolina's International Airport after driving through a fence and onto the airport's tarmac one Thursday night. According to local outlets, the car breached the fence line at the airport and drove onto the tarmac. The car then reportedly retreated from the tarmac and the driver was engaged by police. The car ultimately ended up inside of the terminal after crashing through the doors and windows, and the driver was subsequently detained by police. Now, authorities have not released the identity of the driver or have given further details on exactly how the suspect was able to breach the fence line of the airport. Charges are expected to be filed in this case, and the investigation into the incident is ongoing. I have a sneaking suspicion, though, that this guy was just trying to make it home from a weed lounge. Also in the news, CNBC is reporting that up on the Hill in D.C., the four-day work week is as buzzy as ever, and one California congressman wants to make it a federal law. Representative Mark Takano, who represents California's 39th district, has reintroduced his 32-hour work week act to Congress, which, if passed, would officially reduce the standard definition of the work week from 40 hours to 32 hours by amending the Fair Labor Standards Act. His proposal would mandate overtime pay for any work done after 32 hours, which would encourage businesses to either pay workers more for longer hours or shorten their work week and hire more people. Takano first introduced the legislation to Congress in 2021. It was endorsed by the Congressional Progressive Caucus, made the rounds on the internet, but ultimately failed to advance in Congress. Takano says he's passionate about the 32-hour work week to bring about a significant change which will increase the happiness of humankind. More than 900 workers across 33 businesses in the U.S. and Ireland ran through the same program last year of a four-day work week model, and none of those companies are going back to a five-day work week. Participants in that four-day work week model found that it forced businesses to hire more people, increased labor market participation, and created healthier competition in the workplace that empowered workers to negotiate for better wages and working conditions. They said that the four-day workweek model created a less stressful environment where people were mostly happy. But the best part about it is that workers got to spend an additional full day of the week in the weed lounge. No, actually, the weed lounge wasn't a part of the story. Everything else was, though. And I would love to see Congress passed as law a 32-hour work week schedule. I don't know why the weed lounge thing is so funny to me. It just sounds crazy to me. But right now, I want to shift gears and I want to talk about another gem that I found here in Baltimore City, right here in our backyard. And because it's tax season, I felt it very important for him to come on today. And among other things, give us some information on how to stay out of trouble with the IRS. Now, Tony is a partner in the Baltimore-based accounting and consulting firm of King & King & Associates that his father founded right here in Baltimore way back in 1957. Tony himself has more than 40 years of corporate finance and public accounting experience. He holds a Master of Science degree in Management Information Systems and a Bachelor of Science degree in Accounting. So the man is a true numbers guy. He knows exactly what he's talking about. Tony currently directs the firm's business advisory and consulting practice. He is responsible for all information technology and management advisory engagements. And I am very proud and honored that he's taken the time to come and sit with us today. So without further ado, 1500, please help me welcome Mr. Tony King. Tony, thanks for being with me today. How are you feeling today?
Oh, great. Great. My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Absolutely. Now, listen, this is tax season, and my whole theme is gems in our backyard. And I know that you provide an incredible service as far as taxes go. Like I mentioned earlier, King & King has been around since, what, 1957?
1957, that's correct.
And your dad, I understand, was the very first black CPA in the country. In the state of Maryland, in the state of Maryland.
Yes. Yep.
That's crazy.
The first African-American CPA in the state of Maryland, and which is pretty significant considering that the CPA profession has been around since the 1800s.
Okay. Yeah, it's very significant.
and it wasn't until 1957 that the state of Maryland licensed its first African-American CPA. And at that time, he was also the 48th in the entire country. And one thing that, you know, this is important in our community, because when you think about it, 50 years ago, there may have been 300,000 CPAs
right
in the entire country. But there was only 1,000 minority CPAs at that time.
Why do you think that is? What made that so difficult to get those credentials?
Well, I can tell you from history, and I can also tell you from his history, it was lack of opportunity.
Okay.
And one thing that he shared with me and shared with my other brothers and sisters, because we all followed in his footsteps, there's five of us in the family.
Okay.
And all five of us became accountants and lawyers.
Okay.
we followed the footsteps, and I recall him telling me a story that he could not get a job as an accountant in DC, Washington DC, where he was, you know, where he grew up, because no one would hire him. And even after he offered to work for free, he still could not get hired. So there was obviously some institutional racism back in
Absolutely.
Those days.
Right.
We're talking about the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. One of his professors at American University suggested to him, this is when he was in graduate school, why don't you move to Maryland and set up residency in Maryland, because they have a less restrictive experience requirement.
Okay.
So he moved into Sea Pleasant, Maryland with his uncle. Established Maryland residency, and a year later, the first available time he was qualified to sit for the CPA exam, and that was in 1957, he passed the CPA exam and became Maryland's first black CPA.
Wow.
And the reason that he had to do that is because no one in D.C., he could not get a job in D.C. to satisfy the experience requirement.
What town was it that he was able to get his license?
Well, one thing about the CPA profession is that the exam is uniform. So the same exam that he passed in Maryland is the same exam that someone else passed in Utah,
okay.
In California.
So it's Georgia. Not like a real estate license. These are uniform.
Right. This is uniform.
Okay.
And it's an example. I passed the exam when I was living in the New York area. So my original license is from the state of New York, but I also have a license in New Jersey, North Carolina, and Maryland. So
okay.
I did not have to take the exam five times, but because of the uniform guidance principles within the AICPA, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Now,
okay.
Each state does have its own experience requirements. Vis-a-vis the situation that my father went through, where District of Columbia said, well, you must have 2 years or 3 years or 4 years of experience before you can even take the exam. So that's what held him back in Washington, D.C. Now, just a little bit, one quick history. The
sure.
very, very first African-American CPA was in 1921.
Okay.
All right. So between 1921 and 1957, there were another 43 to 45 African-American CPAs during that 30 or 40 year time period. So one of the issues is that the availability and the opportunity, Brian, and that's what held back most minorities over the last, let's say, 6 or 7 decades.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
What you say?
And even today, I mean, if you just fast forward, today there are roughly 650,000 CPAs that are part of the AICPA, the American Institute of CPAs.
Okay.
And yeah, the numbers have increased tremendously. There may be, out of that 650,000, there may be 6,000, 7,000, maybe 10,000 minority CPAs. But on a percentage basis, that's still...
It's very small. Yeah,
it's pretty dismal percentage.
Yeah, it's very small.
Yeah, very small percentage. Yeah.
Now, are all five of the siblings, all five of your brothers and sisters CPAs, or you guys are just in the business?
Four CPAs, yeah, four CPAs, and one of them is a CPA and an attorney.
Okay.
So it's
crazy because my brother and I are you know, we grew up in the same household, but my mind works completely different from his. I have a creative mind. Numbers, you know, it may as well be Chinese to me. I had to study very hard and work really hard to get good grades in math, where for him, it just came natural to him. So it blows my mind that all five of the kids, you know, all five of you are able to, I don't know, just to tackle this business and do well in it. It's crazy to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that he also shared, I'm pretty sure he shared this with my siblings, is that he told me that, listen, if you want to go to college, when you go to college, you want to major in English, that's fine. If you want to be a history teacher, that's fine. If you want to be an engineer, that's fine. All I'm doing is providing you the foundation for a business that you could own sometime in the future. He never said that, you know, you guys will major in accounting when you go to college.
Okay.
But I think what he was trying to instill in us is that I built the foundation. Now it's going to be up to you guys to carry it on.
Okay. Now, when he started the company, what kind was he in? Because, you know, back then we were sectioned off as far as blacks go. Was he in a section that he was just dealing with only black clientele?
Initially, yes. Initially, yes. His clientele was almost, probably was 100% black and African American and minority at that time. Later, he opened his first office in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And then later, he moved the family from Prince George's County to Baltimore and opened up a second office in Baltimore. And he had a partner who managed the Washington, D.C. office, and he opened up and built the office in Baltimore. Actually, that partner in Washington turned out to be the second black CPA in the state of
Okay.
So we had my father becoming number one, the first black CPA, and 6 months later, another partner of his became the second black CPA. So the firm was born in D.C., and then we moved to Baltimore in 1963.
Okay.
So he had opened up a second office then. And, yeah, 100% of his clients at that time were small mom-and-pop minority-owned businesses, gas stations, retail stores, you know, real estate investors, things like that.
And
but as time went on, we developed a clientele in a base. So he developed that client base that expanded beyond that.
Okay. That was the question,
Being, you know, jobs from the Baltimore City and the state of Maryland and things, you know, things of that nature.
Okay. So at this point where you are now, what do you think your customer base is primarily? Do you think it's 50-50, 60-40, 70-30? How do you think that works?
It's still probably more than a majority, probably more than 50% minority, but it's so diverse because we have business customers who are minority owned, but their demographics of their employees and their customers may be majority.
Right.
So it varies. We do have a lot of customers, businesses and individuals that are not minority. And we do business, for example, we do business with the state of Maryland, the city of Baltimore, the Baltimore City Public Schools. Our reach right now, because of technology, you know, we probably have clients in, I would dare say, probably 15 to 20 different states across the country.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And a lot of those are individual clients, but that still shows you that the advent of technology, you know, from the days when my father first opened up, he didn't even have a computer in his office.
Right. Right.
Yeah. There was no such thing as a PC or a laptop, you know. So technology has evolved our profession tremendously over the last 50 years.
And, you know, people like me, actually, I'm kind of intimidated by the whole tax thing. I've never been very good with numbers and always had somebody else do it for me. What do you find are the things that people get hemmed up the most with as far as the IRS goes when it comes to tax season?
It varies, but for those individuals, and I'm going to exclude business owners right now, but for those individuals, They are concerned about the ever-changing legislative environment.
Okay.
What they were used to 10 years ago is no longer in existence, and what they were used to on last year's tax return, some of those changes are impacting the current year change. And I'll just give you one quick example. There was a major tax law legislative action in 2017 with the former president's administration. It made a tremendous overhaul in some of the things that most individual taxpayers were used to for literally decades, Brian. Wow. For example, they used to be able to deduct upwards of $4,000 for yourself, your spouse, and your dependent children.
Okay.
So if you had a husband and wife and a family of and two kids, you had $16,000 in available deductions that you can no longer take nowadays. Now, that was been in effect since the 2018 tax year.
Okay.
So that impacted a lot of taxpayers because they no longer were able to deduct dependency exemptions for myself, my spouse, and little Bobby and little Jane. So, the family of four, like I mentioned, automatically saw a $16,000 reduction in the amount of personal exemptions that they could claim. Ugh. Now, offset that, the government did increase what is known as the standard deduction. And that simply means that even if you don't own a home and you don't have medical expenses and real estate tax and mortgage interest, things like that, the standard deduction has been doubled from what it was prior to the 2017 Tax Act. So now a married couple, married filing jointly, you can deduct automatically, whether you have these expenses or not, you can deduct automatically upwards of $26,000.
Right.
As a standard deduction.
Okay.
So the government tried to
balance it out or offset.
Balance it out. Yeah. Right. We're going to eliminate the home office deductions for self-employed individuals. And we're going to eliminate the personal exemption dependencies, things like that.
Right.
But we're also going to offset that by one or two lower tax brackets and increase in standard deductions. Okay. Yeah, of course, the question becomes with the 50, 60, 70 million taxpayers who were impacted, did the increased standard deduction offset the itemized deductions that we were now losing?
Right.
And it depends on the family situation. I've had some families of four who lost upwards of $30,000 to $40,000 in deductions. And the change in their tax bracket from 35% down to 33% did not help them at all. So we have situations where a taxpayer used to get a $4,000 refund, and now all of a sudden they owe $6,000 on their tax returns.
Okay.
So it's like you said, it's a balancing act. But right. Every taxpayer, business and individuals, they are different.
There's been a lot of people posing as IRS representatives, and they call and they scam and
yes.
they steal money from people. That happens a lot, unfortunately, with the elderly, right?
Yes.
What
yes.
advice do you give to the elderly? Does the IRS ever call anyone?
No, that's the first thing.
Okay.
The IRS will never place a telephone call to a taxpayer.
Okay.
And I, just talked very, very briefly about two specific instances. About a year or two ago, I had one of my professional clients in D.C. When I say professional, she's a doctor. She called me and said, hey, Saturday morning, I just received a call from the IRS. I owe $8,000 and I need to go buy a gift card right now.
Right.
Okay. So that just tells you right away who's IRS is not going to call you on Saturday morning, because first of all, the government doesn't work on Saturdays.
Okay.
All right. It's funny you mention this, because I had a call yesterday. An elderly client was scammed out of $40,000, Brian.
Oh, my
$40,000.
Oh, my God.
Now, particular case, it was not an IRS scam call, but the demographics are the same, whether it's an IRS call or somebody professing to be from Microsoft in this particular
right.
case.
Okay. Microsoft.
Yep. we just received the notice that your PC has been frozen. You need to do this so we can unlock it for you.
$40,000, well, geez.
The first thing, and of course, this was an elderly person, and she was not even thinking about, well, I don't have a Microsoft computer. I have an Apple computer.
Right.
So why would Microsoft be calling you to ask you to divulge some information if you don't even have a Microsoft product in your house?
Correct.
But, you know, and there's thousands and thousands of those types of stories, Brian. But, yeah, the best advice, whether it's an IRS scam call or it's somebody purporting to, you know, have locked up your Visa account number, if they call you, that's the number one problem. And if they call you, then you should immediately call your bank if it's a credit card. If they say from IRS, it's automatically hang up.
Okay.
That's the thing. IRS does not call taxpayers.
Correct.
But if it's some other potential phishing or scamming scheme, first thing you can do is hang up and call the representative, call the bank or call your credit card company or call your insurance company, whoever it is that's on the other line purporting to be a representative that they're not. But you have to be, you just have to be very, very careful. Hackers and scammers are so, so sophisticated these days.
They really are.
It's just very scary.
They really are. And I feel really bad, really, really bad about the elderly, because those are the ones that get hit the most, because fear is a real thing. They don't want to lose what they have.
Yes, it's absolutely fear. Yes, it is. It's absolutely fear. They, you know, they are threatened to losing their next month's Social Security benefits, everything from Social Security fraud to Medicaid fraud to outright tax fraud, where your Social Security number has been compromised. And then all of a sudden, when you go to file your valid tax return, you get a notice from the IRS that says your return has been rejected because we have a record of this Social Security number already being used and held on a tax return.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that happens quite frequently.
Really?
The number are astronomical from the Treasury Department in terms of those types of scams and tax frauds. Your Social Security number is compromised. Next thing you know, somebody has filed a tax return claiming six exemptions, six dependents and the earned income tax credit. And all of a sudden there's a refund of $4,000 generated under your Social Security number.
What do you think things like TurboTax, is it something, do you find that people, I found that I get more of a deduction when I actually have someone do my taxes as opposed to going through TurboTax. Is that wrong? Am I just being lazy? Like, you know what I mean?
No, you're not being lazy. No, not at all. Not at all. Whether it's TurboTax or some of the other commercial products, TurboTax, Tax Slayer, H&R Block has a proprietary application. Those are not bad programs. You know, obviously, if you have a more complicated tax situation, you may want to seek, or I would strongly suggest you seek the advice of a professional.
Okay.
But the way those commercial products work, it's, from what I understand, and I've never used TurboTax or any of the other ones personally, but the way they work is a series, they put you through a series of questions and questionnaires. So tell me, are you gainfully employed? Yes. Are you a W-2 employee? Yes. If so, enter your W-2 numbers here in this particular field. Are you married? Yes or no? Do you have dependents? Yes or no? So if the sophisticated and not so sophisticated taxpayer can follow that questionnaire format, they work out fine.
Okay.
They work out fine.
Okay.
But sometimes if those taxpayers all of a sudden have capital gain transactions because they sold shares of Microsoft, or they purchased a real estate investment asset, it becomes a little bit more complicated because you need to understand or be knowledgeable of those types of transactions and not just how to flow through and work a PC on a screen with questionnaires questions and answers.
Okay.
So if you came to me, Brian, and said, Tony, I just invested in a limited partnership, and we have I'm part owner of a shopping center in Atlanta, Georgia. You may not want to use TurboTax this particular.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Or in any of the other commercial products. Yeah.
One of the questions that I'm asked often, and that I've asked myself and had questions about, is how much money can you be gifted before you have to declare it on your taxes?
Ah, good question. For the last few years, that number was $15,000. I believe for 2022, it is now up to $16,000. And it has been indexed for inflation every year. Well, okay. Not every year, but every few years. Just as an example, a couple of years ago, the limit was $13,000. Then it went to $14,000. Now it's up to $16,000. So you, as a recipient, let's take it from both. Let's look at it from both angles.
Okay.
As a gifts are generally not taxable at all. I could give you $10,000 today, and you wouldn't pay a dime on that $10,000 that I just gifted to you.
Okay.
Now the donor does have a $16,000 annual gift tax exclusion per individual. So you could give $16,000 to your friend. You could give $16,000 to one of your relatives without triggering any consequences on your part. And even if you exceed the $16,000,
right,
there are what the IRS calls annual lifetime exclusions of up to, oh, wow, the exclusion now is just astronomical. You can gift away millions of dollars as a gift,
uh-huh,
before the donor has to have any consideration or is facing any consideration.
Really?
Of a gift.
Okay.
Yes. So here's a strategy. And just as for your listeners this Sunday morning, on this Sunday morning, if you are a husband and wife and for estate tax planning purposes, let's say you have significant assets and you want to start planning to shelter and gift away those assets to avoid the 35 or 45% estate tax.
Okay.
Once you buy. So husband and wife, they can give $16,000 to their son and daughter. They can give $16,000 to the son and daughter's two kids. They can give $16,000 away to their brothers and sisters. So that wealthy elderly couple who's thinking about doing some estate planning,
uh-huh,
using that $16,000 exclusion, could end up gifting away $100,000 a year or more, and they would not trigger any consequences as long as they don't exceed that per recipient limit.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, and the good thing about it is that the recipients are not taxed on that $16,000
at
all.
They get their full $16K and they keep it, which is great.
Right.
So one other question for me, because this is something that's fairly new. Cash App and Venmo now. Well, those transactions, some of those are being taxed. And they offer services where you can keep records of what you send and what you receive.
Yes.
How does that work as far as that going on your tax returns?
Well, that's a very good point, because one thing that's new, I won't say new, but one thing that is prevalent in today's business environment, and it's been since the pandemic of March of 2020.
Right.
We recognize the importance of that particular date where the entire world's economy was totally shifted and everybody basically had to do business a different way. So the COVID pandemic created what is now known as the gig economy.
Okay.
And what that refers to is that all of these individuals, whether you're tech savvy or not, had to find a new way of making a living when their businesses were shut down by the pandemic. So you had to dig deep into your creative bones and creative genes to say, okay, I can't go to work for the next 6 months, maybe for the next year and a half. How am I going to make a living? So the gig economy was created where you created online support services. You created work from home jobs and opportunities. And as a result of that, these apps, Cash App, Venmo, PayPal, etc., that became the major source of the e-commerce in the banking industry.
Right.
So here's what happens. And notwithstanding the pandemic and all of the ramifications since March of 2020, the IRS has always had a law that says if you pay someone more than $600 a year for services rendered, you must submit to them a form 1099, which is basically a miscellaneous. It's similar to a W-2 if you had a full-time, you know, 9-to-5 job.
Right.
But a 1099 is issued for non-employees, independent contractors, consultants, things like that. So if you've created this gig job or this online job or this virtual job, and you're making thousands of dollars providing those services virtually, yes, you will get, and you use Cash App or Venmo or some other online banking e-commerce facility, you will get a 1099 from that particular vendor, okay. Cash App, et cetera.
Okay.
And a copy of that 1099 is also going to the IRS. So you, as an independent virtual consultant, you just have to make sure that you report all of that 1099 miscellaneous income, and technically you're supposed to report all income whether it exceeds $600 or more or not. So basically the question, or the answer to your question is yes. If you get a 1099 from Cash App or the Cash App merchant service provider,
right,
that may use, you know, one of the Visa providers or something like that, you get a 1099 from them, that should represent any payments that you collected via Cash App that exceeded $600 or more from any one individual source.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that has now become more prevalent since March of 2020 because a lot of people reinvented the way they make money these days.
Yes. You know, a lot of small businesses started, you know, a lot of LLCs were created. But it's one thing to be creative, and it's another thing to create a product that is successful. But knowing how to pay your taxes on the money that you're making, or even wanting to pay the taxes on the money that you're making, is a whole nother thing. And these businesses, a lot of these small businesses are getting into trouble because they don't understand that the money that they receive can't just go in their pockets. They have to pay Uncle Sam a portion. And so they get hemmed up.
Absolutely. That is an excellent point. Now, you know, we've been in business for 6 decades now, and we have run across the entire gamut of, and I'll just say, quote, tax problems. You know, there are income tax problems. There are payroll tax problems. There are certain compliance problems. But you're absolutely right. One of the first things that we advise, and I do a lot of this, and I've done a lot of this over the last thousands of years, but over the last, during my career, I advise clients on the type of structure, the business structure, that they should consider before they just hang a shingle out on their door and say, I'm now open for business.
Right.
And Brian, what I mean by the type of business structure, and you mentioned one of the most popular ones are LLCs, but you can also operate your business as a corporation. You can operate your business as a partnership, and you can operate your business as a sole proprietor. And each one of them has pros and cons.
Okay.
Every single one. Some businesses, sole proprietorship is absolutely wonderful. It is the easiest and simplest, but it's also the riskiest. And so I always tell the client, how much risk are you willing to bear to operate this business? And here's what I mean, Brian. Let's say you are a school bus operator.
Okay.
You have a fleet of 6 or 7 yellow cheese buses. We call them cheese buses, right?
Right.
That's the kind of business that you would not want to be a sole proprietor because you are 100% responsible for all risk in a sole proprietorship business.
Okay.
Meaning you have no liability protection.
Right.
Sure, you can buy insurance, but you cannot insure your way out of a lawsuit. So just imagine you've got a school bus carrying 25 kids and there's an accident. Well, you can almost be assured that you're going to have 25 lawsuits within the first few days.
Okay.
You follow me?
So I got you.
As a sole proprietor, all of your assets are subject to the liabilities of your business. Your house is not protected. Your retirement accounts are not protected. Your bank accounts are subject to the lawsuits, et cetera, as a sole proprietor. Now, there are other business types that a sole proprietor may not be bad. You know, if you have no liability exposure.
Okay.
Then you move to an LLC or a corporation or a partnership.
Right.
Well, again, each one of those, you have liability and risk considerations. LLCs are very popular these days. And just for history, corporations have been around for 100 years, 150 years, maybe 200 years. LLCs have only been around in a great number, probably in the last, I'd say, maybe 40 years or so.
Okay.
And each LLC is governed by state law. So LLCs in Maryland have different requirements than LLCs in Delaware or in West Virginia and California, so forth and so on. But the important thing to note here is that LLC stands for Limited Liability Company. And what that normally does, it provides an umbrella shield over top of the individual. So imagine you're standing outside on your front porch and you raise your umbrella and you step out and it's raining. Well, you are not going to get wet because your umbrella, LLC in this situation, is protecting you from the outside world. So you can create an LLC and do business as Brian Pettaway, LLC, or Pettaway Enterprises, LLC.
Right.
And as long as you have conducted your business without any inference of negligence or fraud or things like that, any actions, legal actions against your company should not be penetrated from that umbrella. So that umbrella, which is the LLC, is protecting you, Brian, personally from the debts the LLC if you do it the right way.
Okay.
Now, gotcha. I'm not trying to provide legal advice because I'm not an attorney, but we're talking about business advice and the ins and outs of that LLC protection.
Right.
And I have to say that there is no form of business that will protect you 100% from personal liability, whether it's a partnership, a sole proprietor, an insurance policy, things like that.
Okay.
Other than that a corporation probably gives the owner the most protection because the corporation is a separate legal entity in itself. And here's a good example. And I'll just use this one. Bill Gates, you know, majority owner of Microsoft, founder, right. Creator of Microsoft.
Right.
If somebody sues Microsoft, Bill Gates is not going to personally lose an hour worth of sleep at night. Because he is not liable at all for the Microsoft lawsuit or the debts of Microsoft.
Okay.
All right. But that's a corporation. That's a regular corporation. Liability, LLCs, there are some debts. And business owners or potential business owners and entrepreneurs need to seek legal and accounting advice to make sure they understand this. There are some debts that even the LLC will not protect you from. One will be the IRS payroll taxes. Two, any debts that the LLC owner signs for personally as a guarantor. And basically what that says is you are the creator and owner of this LLC.
Right.
And you go to the bank and ask for a $25,000 line of credit.
Right.
Bank says, okay, LLC is fairly new. It doesn't have a lot of history, but Brian is an excellent credit rating, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, I'll give you this $25,000 line of credit, Mr. LLC, but your LLC owner, Brian, has to sign for it, guarantee it.
Okay.
So Brian co-signs on a LLC line of credit, and now I'm fine. As long as the LLC pays off that line of credit and makes the required payments, then and Brian doesn't have anything to worry about.
Right.
But if the LLC defaults, the lender still has a course of action
against me personally.
The loan guarantor. That's okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yep. Well, one last question, and that is in reference to April 15th, right, which is, I think, is the tax deadline. Is it still April 15th?
Yes, except that this year is April 18th because the 15th is on the weekend, and this is very crazy that a lot of taxpayers won't even realize why. But obviously, whenever there's a deadline and that deadline falls on a holiday, whether it's tax season or whether it's your driver's license renewal, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's always the next business day. So April
15th
is, I believe, Saturday.
Okay.
Therefore, you would think that April 17th on Monday would be the tax deadline day.
Correct.
Except that there's a little quirk. This is a quirk, something called Emancipation Day. April 17th is Emancipation Day, and the IRS is closed because it's the Emancipation Day in Massachusetts and Washington, D.C.
All right. So
the IRS has to be closed following that holiday, Emancipation Holiday. All so right. Now the actual date gets moved from Monday the 17th to Tuesday the 18th.
Are there tax, and this was the question, are there tax forgiveness dates? Meaning if you go past, let's say, April 18th this year, is there a period of time that you still have to file before the IRS starts sending you letters or start penalizing you for not filing?
Well, yes, and what you're alluding to is that the idea of an extension.
Exactly.
Now, yes, you can file, businesses can file extensions, and also individuals can file extensions on or before the due date of their return. Now, businesses have different due dates. Some businesses have a due date of March the 15th. Other ones have due dates of June 30th, et cetera, et cetera. But whatever the due date is, you can file an extension for that return, and it results in an automatic 5-month or 6-month extension.
Okay.
Now, here's the kicker, Brian. You as an individual file an extension on or before April 18th, and then that means your personal tax return will not be due until October 15th of this year. So it gives you an automatic 6-month extension.
Okay.
That's great. What it doesn't do, and what I always make sure I share with my individual taxpayer clients, is that it extends the time for filing, but not the time for paying. And so what does that mean? Okay. So Tony, now you're confusing me. I can get an extension until October 15th, but you're telling me I have to pay by April 15th. Well, yes, because the IRS says we will give you an extension to file your tax return. But if you think you're going to owe, or if you know you're going to owe, we want you to pay that or make a reasonable effort to pay that on April 15th.
Okay.
Because here's what happens. You file an extension, your return is now not due until October 15th. And when you file it on October 15th, it turns out that you still owe $1,000. Well, the IRS is going to charge you a failure to pay penalty, but not a failure to file penalty. Two different penalties.
Okay.
Failure to file simply means you didn't file on April 15th or get it extended. Failure to pay means that you didn't pay on April 15th and you paid on October 15th once the extension expired.
Got it.
It's important to know that because the failure to file penalty is 10 times higher than the failure to pay penalty.
Okay.
So what taxpayers should be encouraged to do is always file that extension. If you cannot file your return, and let's just keep it at April 15th versus April 18th. If you cannot file that return at midnight on April 15th, then it's a one-page, two-line extension form that you can do online. And your listeners should be aware that they could go to irs.gov, file that extension, and then you will eliminate the major penalty of failure to file on time.
Okay.
Right. Well, and you can even file an extension with a $0 amount. But I'm just suggesting that if you know, listen, you've owed every year for the last 5 years, so you know you're going to owe something when you finally do file that return. My suggestion is that you try to pay something, $100.
A good faith payment, so to speak.
Yes, a prepayment, right.
Okay. Right. And if you're over, then they'll return that money to you, hopefully.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Right. If you know, and not only that, if you know year after year after year after year you get refunds, then a lot of my clients say, well, Tony, April 15th is meaningless to me because I know I'm going to get a refund.
Right.
And that's fine. So, you know, we don't need to do an extension. And I have history with you. You've been my client for 15 years now. And you've gotten 15 years of continuous refunds.
Right.
Unless you've done something dramatic, you're going to get a refund this year. So, no, you know, we don't need to file an extension on April 15th.
Okay.
Yeah. So, okay. Yes, refunds, no penalties, no accruals.
Well, listen, how can my listeners...
Big penalties, big accruals.
Gotcha. How can my listeners get a hold of you?
Sure. We are available on the web at www.king-king.com. It's a king-king.com.
Okay.
And our telephone number is 410-486-4500.
Can I have the website again, the address?
Sure. www.king-king.com.
Awesome.
That's king-king.com. Awesome. And if you go to our website, you'll see the firm's history. You'll see the services that we offer. We try to be as technology advanced as possible. We have client portals. We have a client portal that you can log in from our website. Once you are a client and we register you and get you set up electronically for data transfer, tax return transfers, so forth and so on. So we are a full service firm. We're not just here during tax season. We have a pretty strong audit and accounting practice. We also provide management consulting services, business advisory services, and of course, a pretty robust tax practice.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come out today. I'm going to run a little long, but it's very, very important. Very, very important information. So I appreciate you, Tony, for your nuggets of information today. And hopefully my listeners will get in touch with you and you can help them out as they need to be helped.
Brian, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much. It's
been my pleasure. Thank you, sir. Take care now.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, I know that ran a little long, but hey, it's tax season, and I want you guys safe from the IRS. And I got to tell you, I envy people that are good with numbers, so I appreciate Tony coming on today. But I know you hear the music, and that is time for one thing, and that is the Petty. He's on deck, so let's give Petty a call and see what he's talking about today.
Brother B.
What up, Petty? How you doing today?
I'm doing just great, and I welcome you to invite me to your show this Sunday morning.
I mean, my pleasure, man. You know, we look forward to your segment, brother. You got all the information that puts money in people's pockets. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm going to keep this one a little brief. I only have a little bit on the XFL, but I do have a little something on the NFL.
Okay.
We're going to start with the XFL. You know what? You always say the cream rises to the top, and it looks like those guys from the area, those defenders, they are the best in the XFL.
Yes,
they are
yes.
Undefeated as they took down the other undefeated team last week, the St. Louis Battlehawks.
That was a good game,
man.
That
was a great game.
Yeah.
The XFL, it was great. Hopefully a lot of viewers got to see it. And DC is end up being the top team right now. But you know what? We got to talk about another team that's 3-0, and it's no question why they aren't 3-0, because they're coached by Wade Phillips. We're talking about those Houston Roughnecks. So
Wade Phillips is your boy, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking for the game between the defenders and the Roughnecks. I think that's going to be fantastic.
It is going to be a good game.
But here's a name from the NFL that had some flashes of when he was really, really good in the NFL. And I'm talking about Josh Gordon.
Josh Gordon.
He helped those guys from Seattle, those Sea Dragons, pull out that game with some fantastic catches, especially the one that basically won the game for them. I think he may find his way back into the NFL.
You know, it's weird because although the catch was great, the defenders were horrible. You know what I mean? Like, he's like a man against boys out there.
I noticed that, and I looked at it, and I looked at the highlights, and I kept looking at it, and I said, that guy just looked like he's playing with a bunch of kids out there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was a good catch, but after that, it was like, man, why don't you kids just get out of my way?
Exactly.
That's his end song.
Exactly.
So he may find his way back into the NFL. Now, moving right along, speaking of the NFL, there have been some big names that's going to be moving to different places. And I'm talking about free agency starts tomorrow. And I'm telling you, Brother B, it's going to be something, man. And one of the names, talking about your guy, Lamar Jackson. Now, what the Ravens have done, because a lot of people feel as though since the franchise tag has been slapped on them, that he will be a Raven. And he just may be. But see, there was a franchise tag that was slapped on him, whereas he can negotiate with other teams.
Right.
It's just that those other teams have to give up a whole lot to get Lamar Jackson. And I don't know if they're going to give up 2 first-round picks and the contract that he wants. Right now, as it stands, if he stays with the Ravens and plays, he'll get $32 million.
Okay. Well, guaranteed.
Now, if he negotiates with another team, we're talking about possibly a $200-plus million contract. And they would have to give the Ravens 2 first-round draft choices. I don't know if they were willing to do that. I thought, and a lot of people thought, that he would be going to Atlanta. But those dirty birds said, nah, we'll pass on him.
Everybody's saying that. And I'm trying to figure out, well, they're saying it's because they just don't want to do the Ravens' work for them as far as offering him something. Because if they offer him something, the Ravens have an opportunity to match it, I believe, before they have to let him go.
And that's possible. That is a strong possibility. But I looked at, Derek Carr going to the Saints, and that might be something huge for them because I think they just need a quarterback.
Yeah.
I like the Saints. Hopefully the coach can do something with Derek Carr and that offense.
He's a beast,
Michael
man.
Thomas. Oh, he is. Michael Thomas is excited. If he can stay healthy, the Saints will have their quarterback receiver duo, and they have a decent defense. So the Saints might make some noise in the NFC South this coming season.
All right.
And finally, a little bit of USFL news. I told you I was going to tell you about last week.
Yeah, the cliffhanger.
They had a draft pick, and there's a young man who is, they say, maybe a second coming of Lamar Jackson. And we're talking about Malik Cunningham.
Malik Cunningham.
He's a quarterback out of Louisville. He broke some of Lamar Jackson's records while at Louisville.
Okay.
And Lamar says, you know, he's a pretty good guy. And he even said that he might want to play for the Ravens and study under Lamar. So keep that name in mind. He was drafted by a USFL team. And when he was told of that, he was like, who are they? What are they? I know nothing about this. I have
Young
no interest
buck.
Of going there. He's looking to go to the NFL, only to the NFL. And let me tell you something. He's going to wind up on someone's roster. He is.
Okay.
That young man. Remember that name.
I'm a YouTuber.
Malik Cunningham.
I'm going to YouTube him and see what he's like.
And in a couple of weeks, April 15th, we will see the USFL in action. More to come on those guys soon.
All right. Well, I appreciate you, brother.
And that's basically all I have for you this week, Brother B. You know, I don't sound so excited because there's not too much going on. I tell you this much, I'll be excited next week when I find out all those new faces and new places in the NFL. On that note, Brother B, I'm out of here. Peace.
Peace, brother. Thank you. Well, there goes the Petty. You heard him. You heard him. You heard him. Listen, I really hope Lamar stays here in Baltimore. I mean, I really, really do. I mean, I like the XFL games. I'm looking forward to the USFL games. But I promise you, if Lamar leaves Baltimore, I'm going to have a hard time watching the Ravens in the NFL. I mean, I just will. He's just that dude, you know what I mean? So I hope he stays here. But it's just looking so, I don't know, bleak that possibility is a possibility of him remaining a Raven. We will see. But anyway, the hour has gone by very fast. I know we went over today with Mr. Tony King, but it was worth every second, at least for me. I got some information that I was not aware of before. I will use that information and that knowledge that I gained today and file my taxes. So listen, file your taxes, file them properly, and file them on time, and you should have no problems with the IRS. and you should get some money back, hopefully. And when you do, I'm taking donations. No, but listen, we're into the hour. I really want you guys to have a great Sunday today. Watch games. March Madness is upon us, too. You know, enjoy those games as well. Go Terps. My Morgan State Bears are out of it, so I'm rooting for the Terps now. And today, I want you to tell me how you feel about the marijuana lounge that's going to be going up in Montgomery County. Let me know how you feel about that, if you think it's a good idea, if you think it's a bad idea, and just overall what you think your feelings are about it. Last week, I asked for your feedback on the question of whether the BPD or the car thieves responsible for the death of a pedestrian during a high-speed chase. And to my surprise, most of you said that both the car thieves and the Baltimore Police Department share equal responsibility in the death of Mr. Fincher. And I don't disagree. So remember, give me your feedback. Get at me at On With Brian Pettaway on Instagram, and I will read all of your comments. And if any of them stand out, then I will read them here next week on the air. But until that time, hey, listen, enjoy today, Sunday, relax, chill, do nothing, because, and you know what I'm going to say next, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want, wake up tomorrow, conquer the world, make it a great week, and I will see you next week right here at 9 a.m. on 1500 Radio. Have a great week, people. Peace.